Hi, everybody. I'm Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jennifer.
Can you guys hear me okay? All right. So I am from Woodbridge originally. One of the things I like to do that I've been taught to do in my sobriety is to qualify myself. I have a sponsor. My sobriety date is June 23rd, 2013. And I recently celebrated 10 years, although it was not always as wonderful as it is now. So what it was like, what changed, and what it's like now. What it was like was a train wreck. I have often referred to myself in my life as a dressed up trash can. So on the outside, everything appeared normal. I was very young when my parents decided they were no longer going to be together. And that's one of the only memories I have from my youth. I look at pictures and I don't really remember a lot. I don't remember the things in the pictures. I do remember a lot of the chaos that ensued. And I'll preface my story by saying anybody who's in my story knows they're in my story, and I have their permission to share their parts in my story, kind of like a book. You know, everybody is agreed and signed off that they're in here. So that was when I was about 5 years old. And I remember when I was going to school, feeling very different, because even in the early 80s, being a child who was being raised by a single father was very uncommon. And not having a mother around was extremely uncommon, especially in the area that I was living. It was relatively affluent, mostly military families, a lot of transient people came and went very frequently. So it was hard for me to make friendships that lasted a long time. And I wasn't like other kids. I suspect there was some things going on with me that back in those days, therapy was thought to help. And so I remember going to groups in school, as young as elementary school. And for me, that just solidified and reinforced that I was weird and that I wasn't like everybody else. I also happened to, now I look back on it and thank God, but I grew up on a farm in Northern Virginia, which was very strange. Nobody around me grew up on a farm. And I just, you know, I went to school with a lot of people who were very affluent. In my high school, people drove BMWs and, you know, their parents had endless amounts of money and my family didn't. They worked really hard and people would make comments like, oh, I bet your family's loaded. They have all that land. And I'm like, you should see how hard they work. You have no idea. It's not what you think. It's a lot of work. So other than, different than, that's how I grew up really feeling, you know, that things were different and I wasn't like everybody else. And what I do also remember with being a daughter of a single father was a lot of insinuation that my father was somehow molesting me or abusing me, and that nobody understood what that was, because like I said, that was a really unique thing back in those days. I can actually, one of the things that I do remember from when I was younger are the people who I was in my elementary school counseling with. We all did end up going through school together, and I can remember exactly who was in those counselings with me. So fast forwarding, I started having problems, getting really sick. There was unexplained sickness. We couldn't figure out what was going on. It seemed like I was at the doctor a lot. And what ended up being determined was that I had a stress ulcer. And what the reality was, what I would never really disclose to my father, was how chaotic it was when I would go to see my mother. So she was active in her addiction and I had to grow up really fast. I was around adults 24/7. I didn't spend time with children. So I became very uncomfortable with people my age. And I became very attracted to being with older people and very comfortable having adult conversations. And that made it even harder in school and with others. So she moved around quite a bit. There was a lot of questionable situations for children to be in, boyfriends, things along those lines, bowling alleys. I remember I'd sit in the corner and color all night long till whatever time we got out of there and went home. And we couldn't figure out what was wrong. So my dad enrolled me in soccer. And when I started playing soccer, that was the first time that I felt like I was finally in control of something, that I had a release, and that I had an outlet for all of the things that were going on that I couldn't explain to other people. And one of the things that was really awesome about that is that I met some people who are still my friends to this day. I met my second father, who was my coach, and I'm still really close to him and his daughters to this day. So that helped a lot. At first, I was very shy, very timid. They all used to say, you know, you got to actually play. You can't just let the ball go by you. And by the time I was done, the flip side of it, and this is going to be part of my story, I have a lot of pendulum swings. So one of the pendulum swings, by the time I was graduating high school, I was sitting in front of a committee for the soccer association that I worked with to explain why I had so many penalty points. Because I had become much more aggressive and was, you know, doing things that I probably shouldn't be doing. So I mentioned that because soccer became my life. It was the only thing that I had. It was what I could identify myself as, and it's who I identified with, the people that I played soccer with. So that helped a lot through my school years. But by the time I got to college, you know, I had experimented with drinking in high school and in middle school. My dad did date a woman who was an alcoholic, and, you know, she was also physically abusive to her children. So I witnessed a lot of that violence, usually very late at night, consisted of slamming of things, you know, not really knowing what's going on in the next room, not understanding why this is happening, being very helpless to do anything about it. And one night I had a friend of mine over, and, you know, I think back and it makes me laugh. I was not supposed to paint in my room. And so we were hiding in my closet painting rocks because that's what I used to do. And my dad's girlfriend had caught us. And I thought I was, you know, a real genius. And I ran into the bathroom. And then I realized my friend was still in the closet. I'm like, oh God. So I came out. And when I opened the door, she was standing right there. And this is one of the very few memories I have from my childhood. She grabbed me by the arm and I looked at her and I said, if you hit me, I'll fucking kill you. And I was probably 8 years old. And I was inside, I was terrified. I was like, she's going to hit me. This is going to be really bad. And she just kind of gave me a look like, what? And she just backed away and walked away. And I was like, and in an instant, I look at that now in all the work that I've done with this program. And I see that that was how I learned how to protect myself, through intimidation, through anger, and through verbal expression. And so I knew how to keep myself safe. And that was a tool that I used for a really long time to protect myself from others. So getting more into seeing what was going on around me, drinking was a big part of growing up. My family drank. It wasn't a problem for most of the people in my family. But I could tell that that was something that people just did. You know, I did know my mom drank and I knew she was an alcoholic. And I did tell myself, like, I would never drink and I would never become an alcoholic because it was just awful. And people who are alcoholics are just awful people. And so when I went to college, I did start to drink. I went to Virginia Tech, and a lot of people know it as a party school. And I was around a lot of people who drank like I did. So I didn't stand out, and my drinking wasn't unique. And especially because I was a binge drinker, I always was a binge drinker. I could go days, weeks, whatever without drinking, and it wasn't a problem. And it didn't create a lot of problems. I got really good grades. I graduated from school. I got a good job. Well, I went to more school because that's what you do when you don't know what you want to do. So I was going to school, and that was when I finally felt the opportunity to, what I say, disappoint my family and tell them that I was not going to keep going with school. And a lot of my life, I lived for other people, especially up until that point in my life, because my brother used to get into a lot of trouble. And so I felt sorry for my dad, who had to deal with all of that. So I tried to stay as on the straight and narrow and overachieve as much as possible to please him and my family. Never once thinking about, what do I want? What do I want to do? Is this okay for me? So that was how I flew under the radar, so to speak. So when I did tell them that, that was the beginning of one of my biggest pendulum swings. That was when I decided I wasn't going to live for anybody but myself anymore. And it didn't matter what anybody thought and what they wanted for me, even if it was what was best for me. So I started working in a fitness facility. My background is athletics and fitness. And I was training to do what's called figure competition, which is essentially female bodybuilding, if you're not familiar with that. And I got a pretty significant injury. I didn't know what it was. I went to several doctors and they couldn't quite figure out what it was. And around that same time, I also had a root canal, and the dentist prescribed me Percocets. And I had taken them when I was younger, when I got my wisdom teeth pulled, and I can't tell you whether I knew I liked it or whatever at the time, but I can tell you that when I was in the pain that I was in with my injury, it was the only thing that brought me any sort of reprieve. And I should disclose that my story obviously does include drug use. So I started taking those pills, not for the recommended prescription, but as part of my self-medication. And it became more frequent. I obviously ran out very quickly and had to find ways to feed that need. And it was very easy at that time to do that. So I was obtaining them with very ease, no problem whatsoever. At this time, I still didn't really drink a lot. And my justification in my mind was, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. There's people who come home every day and relax and have a drink. Why can't I come home and relax and take a pill? It seemed to make sense in my mind at the time. So I started seeing a lot of the wreckage that we see in our lives, you know, failed relationships, things are not working out. People aren't doing what I think they should be doing. If everybody would just do exactly what I say, when I say it, life would be grand. I was definitely wanting my play to go off without a hitch. And I was starting to have struggles at work. It was clear to me that that wasn't going to be the place for me. So I thought that moving was going to be the solution. So I decided to move down to Florida to be with my mother, who by that time had been in these rooms for quite some time. And I thought that was going to be a great idea because I'd get away from all this trouble and, you know, this, I won't be able to get these pills because I won't know anybody and it'll be great. And as I now know through the work in these rooms, you know, I went with me. And I can't get away from myself. And so when I got down to Florida, it didn't take very long. I was back to my old tricks. It was easy to find what I was looking for. It was actually a lot easier to find down there because there's, at the time, there was a lot of pain management clinics. So it was something that, again, I was starting to have issues at work. I was starting to see problems in my personal life. And I felt like I was not achieving what I thought I should be achieving at that point in my life. I've always gauged myself by others and in relation to others. And at that time, I was in my early 20s and I was not married. I did not have a stable, steady relationship. I did not have children. And it was like, it felt like when people looked at me, they were judging, you know. I can very clearly remember being at work one time and this very nice gentleman said, he was looking down at my hands and he goes, "Well, how has nobody scooped you up yet?" And I see it now as he was trying to pay me a compliment, but everything about me inside was like, what is wrong with me? Why? I don't know. If I knew that, I would tell you, like, can you find me someone? But he was just trying to be kind, and it really shattered and reinforced all at the same time, everything that I had already decided about myself, that I wasn't worthwhile, that I didn't have anything to give others, and that I was just existing. So I'm gonna say, I don't know exactly what the date was, but I was going through a really difficult breakup, unexpected. And I was living by myself. I had my own place and I decided that I was done and everything was, you know, going to be over. And so I took a bunch of pills and I drank a bunch of alcohol. And there was one phone call that saved me. And it was a longtime friend of mine who I think ended up calling the ambulance for me. I was able to walk out. I was obviously very sick. And the last thing I remember was him saying, "You better stay awake or we're going to shove this down your throat." And I shot him. I said, I'm awake. But that's the last thing that I remember. And when I woke up the next morning, I was in a room. I didn't know where I was. And it was just me and a bed. And there was nothing else in the room. And I remember thinking like, oh boy, this is not good. And so I got up and I went to the door and the door was locked. And I didn't know where I was. So I started to get really scared. And so I knocked on the door at first, kind of just very politely. And then nobody came. And so I started banging on the door, like, let me out of here. What is going on? And somebody came up to the very small window and they just said, "Ma'am, you need to calm down." And I was like, "You need to tell me where I am and why I'm here." And they said, You're fine. We can't let you leave. Unfortunately, the state of Florida has a 72-hour mandatory psychiatric hold for people who attempt suicide. And I said, 72 hours? I was like, I gotta go. I gotta go to work. I have pets at home. Like, you don't understand. You are messing up my life here. You know, never stopping once to think that I was exactly where I needed to be, right? So they just assured me that I wasn't going anywhere and that I needed to take a seat. And so I had a lot of time to reflect, and sooner or later somebody came to the door and they said, "Okay, we're going to move you." I said, "Okay." So I get in this van, and I was escorted everywhere, and I get in this van, and by this time now I was upset, so I was crying. And I remember the man who was driving the van turned around and he said, "It's going to be okay. You're actually going to the nice place." And I said, "The nice place? There's a not nice place? Like, I don't think any of this is nice." And before I went there, they actually had to put me in a holding area that was a communal area. And there was some people there who had some serious psychiatric, and not saying that I didn't, but schizophrenia, screaming, you know, it was terrifying. And I couldn't lock my door. I didn't have my phone. And all I really wanted to do was to contact somebody so that somebody could go take care of my animals and let anybody know where I was, because I wasn't obviously going to work that day. So I finally convinced the person in the office area to let me see my phone, to write down some phone numbers, because I didn't know anybody's phone number. And I called my mom, and she was on a trip and she didn't pick up. So I ended up having to call my aunt, who I didn't speak to regularly. And I just said, "Look, I'm in the hospital. I'm okay. You know, I tried to minimize as much as possible. I just need somebody to go to my condo to let the dogs out and take care of them." And she's like, "Well, what about your mother? Have you talked to her?" And I said, "No." I was like, "That's fine. I'm going to contact her. Don't worry. Just if you could take care of the dogs, that would be great. You know, so I got my mom. I got that under control." And all this time, I wouldn't dare call my father, mostly for fear of disappointing him and hurting him, because I knew that if he knew that I had tried to take my own life, it would kill him. Because he's done nothing but support me and love me through everything. He's been the only person who's ever been there my whole entire life, who's never given up on me. So I could not do that to him. And when I finally got to the place, the nice place, I remember, you know, they showed me to where I was going to be, and everything again was communal. There was no privacy whatsoever. And it was essentially a jail, a very nice jail, from what I understand. Luckily, I've never been to jail yet. So why I even bring this up is because this was my first, when I share in meetings about briefly about my story, this was my first encounter with the steps. And when I saw the 12 steps on the wall, I read and the first few words, and I saw God, and I said, no, thanks, I'm good. And my mind immediately, like it talks about, snapshot. As far as I was concerned, God had done enough for me up until that point in my life. He had done me enough favors. I didn't need anything more from him. I was already miserable enough on my own, and no thanks to him. And the reason that I also bring that up is because when I was younger and going through a lot of the things that I was going through, I used to be very angry with God and say, why would you let a child experience these things? And why would you not help me? And why would you let me suffer like this? What is this? What is this for? What kind of God lets a child suffer or children suffer, when I saw other children suffering? And so I was very angry with God, and I wanted nothing to do with it. So at that point, I was willing to say whatever it took, do whatever it took to get out of there as quickly as I possibly could. And I was discharged, and I was mandated to go to a counselor and to work on a medication regimen that would help me get off of the prescription medication. And so I never touched pills again. And I will say that that was very important to me. However, by that point in my life, how sick I was is that I had convinced myself that drinking was not a problem, because I'm not an alcoholic. I've made it this far. So why would drinking be a problem? So I essentially swapped one thing for another, and my drinking started to really pick up. At first it was like most people, it was a couple drinks at dinner, a couple drinks after work. It was nothing spectacular. And, there was no real wreckage. You know, I had quit taking prescription medication, so my life started to get better, but I still had that restless, irritable, and discontent feeling, that hole inside me that I couldn't explain. And so around this time, the economy tanked and I lost my job. And I waited for about 6 months trying to find another job, because by that time, with the medical treatment that I was undergoing, I couldn't work part-time and be insured. And back then they didn't cover pre-existing conditions. So I had to maintain myself, my insurance somehow. So I was on unemployment for 6 months, and my money that I received from that only covered my subsidized benefits for insurance coverage. So I started to get really desperate, and I started applying to jobs up in Virginia again. And I heard back very quickly, and I knew that I had to come back to Virginia because that was the only place I was going to be able to find employment. So I came back up to Virginia, and in my fairy tale mind, you know, everything happens for a reason, and this is meant to be. And the reason it was meant to be was so I could be with the person who called 911 for me on the night I tried to kill myself, because we're supposed to be together. So that person was one of my best drinking buddies, and we eventually got married. And I've asked my mom since, you know, we are since divorced. And I asked my mom, I said, what must you have thought at that wedding when we were getting married? And she said, I just saw two alcoholics getting married. And I said, why didn't you say anything? And she looked at me and she goes, you wouldn't have done nothing different. I said, thanks, Mom. Because she's right. She's 100% right. I have to learn through experience. I do not learn well through the example of others necessarily. And I certainly, I can look back on these experiences now and thank God that I did have them, because I wouldn't have grown in the ways that I have grown since then. So drinking got really bad, obviously. A lot of it centered around vacation and sporting events and, you know, any excuse there was. And again, still the binge drinking, could go days, weeks without it. So I really did not believe that I had a problem. And now I was surrounded by other alcoholics again. So I was right in my element. And then we went to, my girlfriend and I have similar birthdays, and we went to the Dominican Republic for our 30th birthday. And we were out at dinner, and I remember we were drinking the whole day, because the joke was it was an all-inclusive resort, and we're gonna get our money's worth. We're gonna drink them out of their money. And we were at dinner, and I remember my husband at the time was not drinking his wine as quickly as I thought I would. So I moved his glass and traded glasses. And I'll never forget the look that he gave me. And I remember being really confused, like, what's wrong? And so we get back to the room and we get into a horrible fight. It does get physical, both of us. I never try to put more on anybody other than what I am, an instigator, no doubt about it. I'm short, but I am feisty and I have a bit of a mouth. So I was saying horrible things, and you know, we were definitely in one of the biggest fights we had ever had. And I, at some point, I had pushed him out of the room. And at that point, a bottle full of rum came flying at the door and it crashed. And I felt something hit my leg and I was like, ow. And I got the door shut, and then I looked down at my pants and my pants were cut. And I was like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And so I pulled my pants down and I saw I had about a 2-inch gash on my leg that I could see the bone. And I was like, uh-oh. And I started to panic a little, because I'm in a foreign country and I have this pretty serious cut that is bleeding everywhere. And I'm able to get my girlfriend and say, you know, we got to call somebody. I don't know what to do. So we call whatever the on-call is. And I remember the resort workers coming in and looking around, and I'm sure I can't even imagine what those poor people were thinking. And they took me to the little clinic on the resort, and I'm holding my leg closed, and it's a horrible thunderstorm. And the power keeps going out, and they're trying to stitch me up. And they're saying, we might have to go under the street light, because if the power keeps going out, we're not going to be able to get the stitches in. And I'm just going, oh my God, what is going on? Why is my life such a train wreck? And the next day, nothing happened. Totally normal. And if that's not alcoholism, I don't know what is. Now, I was obviously pissed off because it ruined my vacation and I couldn't swim anymore or do anything like that. You know, I had my priorities very straight. but we didn't speak about it. And it was as if it had never happened. And so we got back home and I finally said, you know, I really think you have a problem, talking to my husband about his drinking. I think you really have a problem. I think you have a drinking problem, and I think you need help. And he's like, okay. And he, God bless him, he had some, you know, DUIs and things like that. So it was obvious to me who had the problem, right? It was very, very obvious. So he's like, okay, well, I'll go to AA. And I said, okay. And I said, I'm going to go to Al-Anon. I'm going to be a good supportive wife, and I'm going to go to Al-Anon. So I remember the first meeting I went to, And the ladies, God bless them, they were like, oh, he's horrible. You need to leave him. And they were so sweet. They were just trying to be supportive. And I sure was not telling the whole truth, I doubt. And so I left there and I'm like, yeah, they're right. He is the bad one. And I'm, you know, I'm not doing anything. And so I started going to Al-Anon more regularly. And when I do share about my story, I always say that I came in through the back door and I got here by accident. So I had met a nice lady in one of the meetings that I was regularly attending. And we agreed to meet up on a Friday night at a church. I did not realize it was a dual meeting, that in one room they had the AA meeting and in the other room they had the Al-Anon meeting. So I'm sitting in this meeting and it's 8 o'clock meeting on a Friday night. And I'm waiting and I'm waiting. And then they start the meeting and I don't see her. And I'm like, this bitch didn't even show up. So I'm like, okay. And they started talking and I was like, wait a minute. And then they were like, and now we're going to go around the room and introduce ourselves. And then everybody started saying, I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Jan, I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in the wrong one. And I'm like, what do I do? What do I do? And so my brain, my fast thinking is, it gets to me. I'm Jennifer, I'm an alcoholic. You know, just keep going. Just don't mind me. And that really was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because when I walked out of that meeting, I had heard in Al-Anon to go to AA meetings to try to understand alcoholics better. But when I walked out of that, I had the strangest feeling of relief. Like, wow, you know, everybody there was really happy and they had some pretty horrific experiences in their life, but they had done a lot of work and they were really trying to make changes in their life. And it sounded like they had the things that I wanted. And so I don't know why I thought maybe I'll go back next week, you know, because I'm just trying to understand the alcoholic, doing my research. So I went back the next week and I tried to sneak in and sneak out and, you know, not talk to anybody. And then this very tall, long, gorgeous, blonde hair, beautiful woman came up to me and introduced herself and says, hi, I'm Kayla. And I was like, hi, you know, I'm Jennifer. I gotta go home now. And she was wonderful. She talked to me. She wouldn't really let me leave. She asked me what meetings I go to and do I have a sponsor? And the light in her eyes was so, it shone so bright that it was magnetizing. You couldn't walk away from it. And so she had told me that there was a meeting that the Sunday night at 8 o'clock and that she was going to speak and would I come? And I said, sure, I'll come. And when I heard her share her story, I thought, oh my God, I know that. That's my life. I've lived in that exact chaos that you're describing. And she was newer to sobriety at the time. And I just remember thinking like, okay, this is not what I thought. I had a lot of assumptions. I thought that being an alcoholic was doing the things that I had seen, you know, and or living under a bridge. I had just really not good assumptions about what alcoholism looked like. And when I saw more and more people, I started going to more and more meetings and I pulled up the big book online because see if I bought it, that would mean I thought I was an alcoholic. So I just read it online. And I remember telling my mom, you know, this book is really good. Like, this book is awesome. And she goes, yeah, it was written, you know, a long, long time ago. I thought you would have really liked the NA book. I was like, no, this is great. This is good stuff. And I was like, why do you think I like going to these meetings so much? And she's like, I don't know. Obviously, she knew the whole time. So I started going to more meetings and around 90 days, because this whole time I had convinced myself that I was just doing this in support of my husband and I had quit drinking. I even did the test of when you go out and just order one drink and try not to order any more. And I can very clearly remember that dinner with my family being really mad that nobody else wanted to order more. and just sitting there thinking about it the whole time, like, you guys always order more. Like, why tonight? The one night when I, you know, could be like, well, it was just a test and see, I'm fine. So I just remember feeling a sense of unbelievable relief when I would leave the meetings. Contrasting that with my husband at the time, he was trying to go to more meetings also. So I started saying, well, come with me. We should go to these meetings. And this one's really great. And these people are really great. And we would not have the same experience. And I started to think, like, oh my gosh, like, what is going on? Like, why can't he get it? You know, I'm not even the one that has the problem. And around 3 months is when I really realized, you know, I was exactly where I needed to be. I had finished reading the big book and I had heard my story. And I realized that, you know, I obviously had just as much of a problem as he did. So that is what was the catalyst for me to make a change in my life. But it was not the type of experience that was rapture or, you know, a bolt of lightning. It came over time. I had to learn and I had to experience slowly and I had to go at my own pace. And I remember probably about 6 months in, I was at a meeting and I was approached by somebody else in the meeting, and we were talking and they said, well, did you get a sponsor yet? And I was like, well, I mean, and I'm like, on cue, he looked at me and goes, oh, you're doing that a la carte sobriety, are you? And I said, what? No. What are you talking about? I have a sponsor. And so immediately I asked some people, a couple people, if they would sponsor me. And I started to work the steps. And I remember when I started to work the steps, feeling so afraid that I would leave something out of my fourth step that would send me back out to drinking. Like, what if I'm forgetting something? But what about this? Is this important? Should I put this in here? And I threw myself into everything as much as I possibly could. I do not have the same sponsor that I had when I first got sober. And I'm eternally grateful for the woman who I did have who walked me through the steps, because she did it right through the big book, right like it says, and it was exactly what I needed. Around that same exact time, like I said, this is about 3-4 months in, I was on my way home from work, and I had gotten my motorcycle license because I didn't want to sit in traffic commuting from Fairfax, Arlington to Woodbridge. So I was on my way home, and I was sitting in stop-and-go traffic, and a car almost ran me over. And I don't know how, I think it was pure adrenaline, but I did not drop my bike. And when I finally got my bike up, I don't recall exactly what happened other than I attacked their car. And I very calmly after that got back on my motorcycle and went home. And so not too long after that, somebody was at my door, knocking at my door. And it was a police officer. And I said, I'm pretty sure I know why you're here. And so it was, thank God I was not handcuffed or anything. But I had to go down to the magistrate. I was charged with destruction of property. And the worst part of all that, and why I share this part of my story, is because that's the kind of blind rage I am capable of. And I know that about myself. And what I didn't know at the time is that that person had children in the car. And it's been one of the hardest things for me to work through with my sobriety, because I have kids. And if that would have happened with my kids in the car, I don't know what I would have done. And that person didn't intentionally try to run me over, right? I mean, traffic is traffic. But that's something that I have to remember. I can be very dangerous when I'm angry, and I can say and do horrible, horrible things. And alcohol only fueled that for me. And even taking all that away and everything that I had done up to that point, I didn't understand why I still couldn't control myself. Why is my life still such a train wreck? Why are these things still happening? Why can't I be in control of myself? And what the reality was is that I was a very sick person. I am a very sick person, and I'm not just an alcoholic. And part of my story is that I suffer from mental illness. I manage it now. And around that time, that really woke me up to the fact that I needed help more than just what the rooms could give me. And so I took a leave of absence from my job, and I entered into a partial hospitalization program, intensive outpatient, and it saved my life. I felt like, and I told the counselors in there, I felt like they finally issued me the manual to life that I never got issued when I was born. How to handle situations and why my mind went in the direction that it went and how it did because of how it had wired itself when I was younger. So kind of going back, like I had told you about that story, when I feel threatened, my instinct is to attack and to lash out and to rage and to protect myself. That's not normal. That's not how you have constructive conversations. It's not how you solve problems. It's not how I solve problems, I should say. And so this group offered me that opportunity to see things in a much different perspective. They diagnosed me, like I said, with different mental illnesses. I won't get into a lot of that because, you know, that's outside of this topic. And it's something that I have to manage every day. And it's something that I manage as best that I possibly can. That has been hard for me in my journey in recovery because not a lot of people understand mental illness and how it can impact people's ability to see clearly. And so I try to talk about it because somebody talked about it in a meeting that I was in. And I finally didn't feel so alone in AA too, because I saw that recovery was possible from both, and that it was going to take work, and that I may need to seek outside help. So I just encourage anybody who ever feels that way to do that and to not be deterred if you are in a similar situation. Recovery is possible even with outside issues. So where things are and how I got to where I am today. I was actually at a meeting a couple weeks back, and I was a little emotional because it was my 10-year anniversary. And every time that I hit a milestone, and especially every time around that year, I very clearly remember what I was doing right before I got sober. And it was very dark, and it was very scary. And I'm just so grateful that I don't live that today. But how I got here was through the steps, no doubt about it, and through sponsorship. My sponsor in the beginning walked me through, like I said, right out of the big book. And it took time, but she helped me to see that these are the things that need to be done in order to achieve long-lasting sobriety. And if it weren't for her and sitting down with me and taking that time and going line by line and reading it back to her, I don't know where I'd be today. So sponsorship is key. My sponsor today is one of the most wonderful women I've ever encountered. I've heard her share her story, and I still can't believe she's here with us. And I hope that maybe one day that's the light I can shine for people, is that it doesn't matter what you've done. It matters what you do moving forward. And I have to think about that every single day. I was encountered with a situation actually recently where I wasn't sure what to do. And I had to really look at a lot of different aspects because my decision on what I was going to do wasn't going to just impact me. It was going to impact my whole family. And that was for us to move down to this area. And to leave my job that I had been at for quite some time. So I did what I know to do these days. I know to talk to people. I know to ask questions. I know to reach out. lean into my network. And we were right around the same time that I started my new job. You know, unfortunately, we lost one of our really close friends. And his son is just a few months older than my son. And now he doesn't have a father. And it's horrible because that's what this disease does. And his wife, we met with her and got the kids together. And she told us that when she found out that he had gone back out, he said to her, "I haven't hit my bottom yet." And he did. And I think that I never want to test that. And I hope I never feel like I'm that hopeless that I go to that length to see what further my bottom can go, because it was as low as I ever want it to be. And that's the reality. He had just as much time as my husband, and they had a joke, and it was a joke, that he would catch him one day, you know, because it was just a couple months. And never once did we think that he really would catch him. And so I see that I'm just as vulnerable today after the time that I have as I was the day that I walked in. And I have to do the things like come to meetings, like speak in front of groups, like reach out to others, talk to my sponsor, make contact, and live this every single day of my life. Because if I don't, my life will end, and it will end in a very sad and scary way. I know that now. The hope in this story, though, I have now, I am remarried. I have a wonderful husband. I have two amazing kids, even though they drive me crazy. I live with my mother. She lives with us, and we do the best we can with that situation. God bless her and bless us too. And I have a great job. I live closer to my family, who relocated to this area about 2005. So it's, nobody can tell me that there aren't gifts of sobriety, because there are amazing gifts in sobriety. I was the person who, because I felt like I wasn't going to live up to everybody's standards, I was never getting married and I was never having kids, and that was that. And here I am on my second marriage, and I got two kids, and life is very beautiful. And I'm grateful every single day that the second time around, the second time I saw the steps, when I saw God, I didn't close my mind, and I tried to keep an open mind. And I'll finish with one last story. Probably a few years ago. So my oldest son is my stepson, and he's 13. And he came with us. He came to live with us when he was 6. He had been living with his mom, and she was really struggling. And so he came to live with us. And I remember one night I was sitting outside. I was lying down on the lawn in the front yard, and I was just looking at the stars. I took a big deep breath, and I said, like, something in my mind said, I had more big kid problems when I was a child than I have today as an adult. And in that exact moment, I thought to myself, oh my God, the reason God did that, God allowed that in my life, was so I could be there for my oldest son with what he's gone through with his mother. And as an 8-year-old back in that time, 5-year-old, 6, I thought God is evil and he allows children to be hurt and live in pain and suffering. And if I hadn't gone through those things and I hadn't experienced that, how could I ever comprehend what my son is going through? How could I ever be there for him and comfort him and say, you know, today it might not be okay, but it might be later, and we got to just stick through it. And that's the only thing I can give him, because I can't change it as much as I would want to. And I can't do anything for him except show him that hope and recovery is possible, but also you can make it through this, even when you're young, even when you're suffering, is that this doesn't last forever, and you can use it later in your life to be there for other people. So just super grateful. Thank you so much for letting me share tonight. I really appreciate it. I hope it wasn't too gory of a story. And thanks for your time.